There are some folks who will tell you that David wrote all the Psalms. And then there are other scholars who will say, no, David wrote some of the Psalms, but others were not written particularly by David. Then there are some scholars who will say, David didn't write any of those. They were written for worship in the temple. They were written to be sung as you processed into the temple or out of the temple or took refuge in the temple. And, of course, the temple wasn't even built until after David's time. David was not allowed to build the temple, if you recall, because he had too much blood on his hands. Not only did he kill the giant Goliath, he killed a whole host of other people. And when it came time for him to express his desire to build a house for God, God said, no, you have too much blood on your hands. And so it was his son, by Bathsheba, interestingly enough, named Solomon, who actually built the temple. Well, maybe it's my background in literature, but quite frankly, I'm less concerned with who wrote the Psalms than I am with what they teach us and what they say. So in terms of who wrote them, you believe whatever you want to. But let's look at what this psalm says, because I think it's important. The person speaking this psalm, whether it be David recollecting that boyhood event with the giant, or just someone else recognizing that terrible times come to all of us. Did you hear the description? My enemies devour my flesh. My adversaries spread lies about me. I mean, it sounds like an election season, doesn't it? Right? This person is being mistreated. It acknowledges that there are enemies out to get this individual, that they don't tell the truth about this individual, and yet, through it all, there is a basic trust in God. I believe I will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living while I'm still alive. Don't have to die to see the goodness of God. How do we praise God when things go wrong, terribly wrong, when terrible, awful things happen in our lives, unimaginably hard things happen in our lives, or when we're in situations where we are so afraid we can hardly move? A number of years ago, I heard an interview with Elie Wiesel. You probably know Wiesel from his novel Night, based on his experiences as a child at Auschwitz. Like David, he was a boy when he went through these fearsome experiences. You may know some of his other novels or some of his other books about his Hasidic family. In this interview, he tells a story about a tribunal that was set up at Auschwitz. He was still a boy. He wasn't part of the tribunal, but he observed it. A minion of adult male Jews put God on trial. The charge brought against God was that God had deserted the people. God had neglected the people. That these terrible things that were happening would never have happened if God had taken notice. And so there was great discussion in defense of God and prosecuting God. At the end of the trial, God was found guilty of neglecting the people. After that, there was a silence before the interviewer asked the next question. Finally, he asked Wiesel, what did you do then? I mean, what do you do when you have found God guilty of deserting the people? He said, we went and prayed. What else? In the midst of the worst that human beings can experience, even when we cry out to God for justice that doesn't seem to be coming, we pray. We offer thanks to God for even those things that we experience that don't seem to be in our interest. Last week, you know, we talked about God having our self-interest or our best interest at heart, but sometimes that goes against our individual self-interest. Doesn't take that into account, but God has the interest of all of us, all of creation at heart. We don't always see the good in the things that we experience as terrible. We don't always see the seed of destruction in the things we experience as good. Let me give you another example. I've begun to give myself a reward on Fridays. Now, Friday is the day I usually try to take away from the office. And this particular reward is that I get to sit in on a class at Vanderbilt Divinity School taught by one of the associate deans, Victor Judge. I met Victor several years ago when we here in Nashville were all reading The Life of Pi. And I was asked to moderate a panel down at the downtown public library. It was an interfaith panel, and Victor was one of the panelists. His insights were so profound and struck me with such force that I asked him if he taught classes, and if indeed he did, could I sit in on them sometime? He said he did, and he teaches classes in Flannery O'Connor, and he teaches a writing class, and he teaches a class on Emily Dickinson, and he teaches a class on William Faulkner. And so on Fridays this term, from 11 to 1, I sit out on that class on William Faulkner. Now, the first book that we read was The Sound and the Fury. If you've tried to read The Sound and the Fury, I emphasize try, you know that the very first section of it is told through the consciousness of a 33-year-old mentally challenged member of the Compson family named Benji. That consciousness is free-flowing and is not confined by space and time, and so it can be really, really, really confusing and really, really, really discouraging, and a lot of people never get past that first section to read the two other sections through the consciousness of the two other Compson boys, or the last section, which helps put it all into context. I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to do something that preachers aren't supposed to do. Now, there's a surprise, right? I'm going to tell you a story that's only peripherally related to the theme today, but I'm going to tell it because I want to tell it, because I like the story. It's my favorite story about William Faulkner. After he'd won the Nobel Prize, some of Faulkner's hunting buddies decided they ought to read some of his books. They had never read anything by him. He was just Bill Faulkner. So this one fellow who owned a garage, a gas station, decided he would start with The Sound and the Fury. And as you might imagine, that first section did him in. The next time Faulkner drove by to get gas, he said, Bill, I want to ask you something. He said, you know, I started reading that book of yours, The Sound and the Fury, and I just wondered, were you drunk when you wrote that? And Faulkner said, not the whole time. It's that kind of section. It's hard to get through. And it really only makes sense, if it ever does, in the context of the rest. There are some folks who would suggest that Benji, through whose consciousness that section is told, is a kind of Christ figure. He's 33 years old. He's male. He's unmarried. It never made sense to me, quite frankly. All of those are superficial. But I do believe there is a Christ figure in the book. And it's not Benji. The last section of the book is not told through the consciousness of any of the Compson family. In fact, in that last section, Faulkner steps back. And he describes an Easter morning when the African-American servant, who has literally served all her life in the Compson household, whose name is Dilsey, awakens and gets ready to go to Easter Sunday services. He doesn't try to tell it through her consciousness because he did not believe that as a white male Southerner, he had any business trying to speak through the consciousness of an African-American woman. But he simply describes her. And the opening paragraphs of that fourth section, in my opinion, are some of the most beautiful prose you will ever read. It's fairly simple and straightforward, fairly easy to understand. He simply describes Dilsey coming out of her cabin to begin to make preparations for breakfast for the Compson household. And the Compson family is literally falling apart. Dilsey has been the glue that has held the family together. She and the other African-American servants, but primarily Dilsey. She comes out dressed in purple, which of course is the color of Lent, but it's also the color of Advent. It's also a royal color. She's dressed in purple, in her finery. Her body, which had been strong in her early days, was now falling away to skin and bone underneath this beautiful purple dress. As she comes out, she notices, although she's completely ready to attend Easter Sunday services, she notices that luster has not filled the wood box, which means that she's going to have to fill the wood box before she can make breakfast, before she can serve the Compsons, before she can go to the Easter services. So she goes back in the house. And when she comes back out, she's not dressed in the purple anymore. She has on an old ratty overcoat and an old hat. And she comes and she gathers up the wood and she fills the wood box so she can do what she needs to do before she goes to celebrate the resurrection. Now, I'll be honest with you, I had not recognized this as an image of the incarnation until this past Friday. And how much of this is me and how much of this is Victor Judge, I will give him the credit for anything smart or good that comes from this, okay? But isn't that what Jesus did? He who had the royal purple, he who lived through the Advent and the Lent and the Holy Week, isn't he the one who stepped away from that royal position and put on the overcoat of human flesh and put on the tattered hat of human mind and did for us what we either didn't do or couldn't do for ourselves? I'd never seen that before. It's Dilsey who is the Christ figure in this book, not Benji. It is this African-American woman who has lived under every kind of oppression you can imagine, who is living in the Jim Crow South, who has been a servant her entire life, and who is the only one holding the family together at this point, and the only one who really treats Benji like a human being. She takes Benji to church with her. When she has done all of this preparation, she's finally ready to attend Easter services, and she takes this 33-year-old mentally challenged man with her. He can't go to the white church. You see, he can't talk, but he makes noises. He moans and he bellows. On the way to church, she hears the talk about him. They call him loony. She's violating the law in even bringing him to her church. She's violating the code of segregation of that time, even bringing him to her church. But that doesn't seem to matter to her. When she hears the talk of those people thinking it's a shame that she brings him, she shushes them and she says, you know, God don't care if he's smart or not. Only white trash cares about that. And she sits with him in the church, the one white face in this African-American congregation on that Easter morning. And there is a moment in the service where Benji's face is beaming. He's experiencing something that he cannot articulate and no one around him can fully know. But she has taken him into the place where we expect to encounter the presence of God. And in some strange way, this one who is not smart has encountered that presence. And Dilsey puts her hand on him and she begins to weep. Isn't that what Jesus does for us? Doesn't he bring us into the presence of God in ways that we cannot fully articulate, we cannot completely understand? A love that receives us in all of our limitations? Isn't that what Jesus does for us? Isn't that why we can offer praise even in the worst of circumstances? Because we know we're not alone in this. And that there is someone who gave up royalty to take on the overcoat of flesh and the tattered hat of mind and to take us into the precinct where we can experience the presence of God in ways that we cannot fully speak about. Isn't that something to offer praise for? Even if your mother or father reject you, the psalmist says, God will welcome you. Benji's mother and father and brothers had basically rejected him. But Dilsey loved him and brought him to the place where in some way we can't understand, and I'm sure he couldn't understand, he experienced something beyond words. The love of God. That's why we welcome all. And it doesn't matter your skin color. And it doesn't matter your immigration status. And it doesn't matter your ethnic background. And it doesn't matter if you're smart or not. Because you see, none of those things matter to God. We simply come together in the presence of God, praying that we too will have that experience. That helps us understand that even should our parents reject us, God still receives us. That in spite of all of our limitation, God still works in and through us. Isn't that something to offer praise for, even in the worst of circumstances?